Season 2 of Assessment in Focus, the podcast from Inspira, where we invite our guests to share their insights on assessment, transformation, innovation, and enhancement. My guest on this episode is Dr. Patricia Broadfoot, who is Professor Emeritus of the Sociology of Education at the University of Bristol. She's a former head of the School of Education, Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences, and Pro-Vice-Chancellor at the University of Bristol, and was Vice-Chancellor of the University of Gloucestershire here in the UK. She's a Fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences and was awarded the CBE for Services to Social Sciences. Patricia's research has focused on the social role of assessment. She recently published a book of collected works entitled The Sociology of Assessment, Comparative and Policy Perspectives. Her current research interests are in the potential impact of artificial intelligence on the social role of assessment. And an example of that you can find in the podcast notes with an article from the Oxford Review of Education. Patricia, thank you very much for joining us on this episode. I'm delighted that you're a guest.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Great. Well, I'm going to start with looking at where we are today and asking you, where do you currently see the most promising innovation in assessment?
Yes, I think there's been quite a revolution in assessment thinking and practice under the last, I suppose, 30 odd years. I know it sounds quite a long time, but it's not long in the great history of assessment. And I think it dates back to the 1980s and a very influential paper by Paul Black and Dylan William about assessment for learning. It was called Into the Black Box, but it's about assessment for learning. And from that time, educators of all kinds have come to realise both the impact of assessment on students' learning and also how it can be used to support learning. And I've done work myself since then on a tool, for example, called the Evaluating Lifelong Learning Inventory, which is known as ELLI for short, but is a tool to help students, for example, understand their strengths and weaknesses as a learner and to get better at learning as a result. It's a self-assessment tool. So that's just one small example of the way in which educators have begun to realise that if they use assessments sensitively, mindful of the psychological impact, huge psychological impact that assessment has, that they can really support students to be better learners, both generically and in specific subjects and contexts. So I'm really excited about that. And I think that, as I say, there's been something of a revolution because those sorts of ideas have gone around the world now and are really transforming what people do in actual practical settings.
One of the things that students might say in response to being given a self-assessment tool is, am I ready for this? How do we make sure that students are in the best position to be reflecting on themselves, particularly when we think of the move from school to university or from undergraduate to postgraduate, which is can be seen as a jump in levels over and above that of, you know, individual years at university?
It's I think we've done a huge amount of damage to what is naturally there in most learners, namely the desire to know and to learn. For some of the research we did with our ELLI tool, for example, showed an absolutely cataclysmic drop in the amount of creativity that students exhibited as they go through the school system. We squeeze it out of them because we teach them to jump through hoops, as you and I both know. At university, obviously, the idea is that you, quote, read for a degree, and it's all about developing your own thinking and your own take on a subject. And so it's very important that students should be able to learn, to be powerful learners, if you like, and not expect to be spoon-fed. But unfortunately, the evidence is the opposite, that mostly students nowadays are trading for grades, as the saying goes. So in terms of preparation for study at university, I think schools are getting much cleverer at understanding how they need to prepare students through the kind of assessment for learning I mentioned. But I'm not sure yet that universities are well equipped to support them when they get there, because the sheer numbers, if nothing else, of people in the higher education context.
Those numbers, of course, present a barrier or challenge, which takes me to my next question, and it may form part of the answer, or you may have something else, which is, what do you see as the real barrier or barriers to assessment change right now in policy, in systems, in processes, or indeed in habits from educators?
That could take us quite a long time to answer that question. Awful lot of barriers. There's a simple answer, and then there's a more complicated answer, I think. And if you will allow me, I'd like to go back to first principles, because in my original work and in the latest article that you cite at the beginning, we go back to looking at the social purposes or the social functions of assessment in society, not just for an individual or a school or a university. And I have argued, and I think the argument is still valid, that assessment is, we have it, educational assessment, because we can't run society without it. So, for example, the first kind of educational assessment that was invented within modern society was the assessment of competence, you know, whether you're a competent doctor or lawyer or whatever. And then that wasn't enough. So we had to identify through competition who were going to be the best doctors and the best lawyers. And competition is still absolutely fundamental in society. And most people understand that. But the other two things that are perhaps less obvious, one is that through assessment policy, we control what schools and universities teach, and whether it's formally there or just by implication, what goes in the exam tends to drive what gets taught. So there's the content thing. And then finally, perhaps most difficult to understand, and certainly something I came to as a kind of revelation to me, is the way in which governments use assessment policies to control what institutions do, and national systems, even national systems of education. And by so doing, they also control what teachers prioritize and what students prioritize too. So there's a whole kind of washback effect in the system. So you asked me what the barriers to change are. I think the barriers to change fundamentally is that we cannot yet envisage a society without those functions of educational assessment, because you couldn't. At the moment, we depend on them for attesting competence, which is important, but also sorting people into winners and losers. And the important thing for me in terms of barriers to change is that the public, whoever they are, accepts this system. And by and large, students and families accept the results of our assessment system when we have public exams and so on. So there's a huge point about legitimacy, that when you try and change the system, people say, oh, well, I don't think that's going to work. It's not fair to my child. Da, da, da. So I'm going to put those various things together. So first of all, governments copy each other around the world, and they tend to use assessment in the way that seems right to them, which is tried and tested, and they're very reluctant to do anything that might challenge the legitimacy. But the second thing I would mention actually is completely different, and that is that there hasn't been historically a lot of thinking about the purposes of assessment. I think the advent of assessment for learning, which I mentioned, is perhaps the first time that the educators and education people in the education system have actually thought very hard about why we have assessment, what we want it to do, what's the best way of doing it to achieve those goals. So I would call that fitness for purpose. And there has been, until relatively recently, a terrible lack of assessment literacy, in that people use this incredibly powerful blunt instrument without really thinking about it, you know, let's do a test kind of stuff. So there are these, as you call them, personal habits that exist within the education system. And then there are profound social mores and social needs, which also inhibit change. And that adds up to a lot of barriers, really.
Assessment literacy is the bit that I'd like to pick up from what you've said, as the first of potentially hundreds of follow-up questions, but definitely the one I want to ask first. What, in your view, what do we need to be doing to improve assessment literacy, both as educators and for students? Because I think all too often when we talk assessment literacy, we're talking about students understanding their assessment, which is a very narrow definition of it. So thinking broader, both from an educator and a student perspective, how should assessment literacy be improved?
I suppose the first thing we need to do is problematize it so that we challenge the ready assumption. I mean, I take an example about something I've been concerned with throughout my career is the language we use to talk about students. And we talk about bright students and slow students. And you know, we use epithets which are very, very powerful, but not necessarily very meaningful or helpful. And so I think the way we could help people working within the education system, whether they're learners or educators, is actually to actively teach assessment. That might sound a bit odd, but many, many schools that I'm familiar with, and indeed universities, are actively teaching students why self-assessment matters, how to consume the feedback they get, and doing really powerful work, I think, to integrate assessment positively into the learning process. But we do come back to your previous question, which is that the system, say a university, requires assessment material or language, might be written in words, for example, you know, feedback in words. Mm. It requires it to be translated into a code called 75% or B minus or something like that. And immediately something else happens and people start, we all do it. I mean, you know, yeah, we all want to be marked and we all want a good mark. And as soon as that comes in, it becomes very difficult. So I do see a very fundamental tension between helping people to understand how their learning is going and what they need to do to say, if I was studying a course now as a mature learner, I would want my coach or my teacher to say, well, X is going really well, but Y is your problem. And this is how you could work on your problem. That's what we're talking about. That's formative assessment. But as soon as you get into the summative mode, all sorts of things take over. And I can remember doing a learning Spanish as a continuing education project years ago. And we got very nice feedback from the teacher. And then at the end of the day, I got a very poor mark for the particular module. And I said, why'd I get such a poor mark? Well, you didn't turn up to all the sessions.
Right.
And I thought that was terrible, completely unjust and unmeaningful. But that's the way people use assessment. That's just really crude and unfortunate. So we're talking at something that stretches from the individual learner in some kind of setting or classroom right through to somebody in the top of government deciding what they want to do with the assessment system in their country. And it's very, very difficult to get all those wheels working in harmony with each other.
Particularly on the scale point or what letter or percentage you got, it does feel like that is of greater benefit to others than the student who receives it, because it's someone being able to see in a comparative sense where you were, or on an absolute scale where you were. Do you envisage any way in which we can move to assessment that doesn't have that numerical or letter grade at the end of it, which again is for the purpose of someone probably other than the student? Is society ready to accept that, or will they find a new proxy by which to recreate the letter or number that we've removed?
Yeah, very, very good question. Really important question, because it's where we're at, I think, at the moment. I wrote a paper a few years ago with some colleagues at Bristol called something called Time for T, but T being technology enhanced assessment. And we did a piece of work looking at prevailing practice in terms of people using technology to enhance their assessment practice. And we concluded that there's terrific potential to change what we've been talking about by using online assessment, nothing fancy, just ordinary online assessment, because there is so much more scope to personalize it, to let people do an assessment when they're ready, to get feedback when they're ready, to do it at a time that suits them and they can perform best, and also to do a variety of tasks which you can't do in a more formal setting. So we looked at all that and we thought, well, gosh, the outcome of that, you could have a much more granular system whereby people acquired credits along the way. And there are systems like that out there which are working, where, as in universities, the modular systems that used to be very popular, you could get accumulation of modules, and it helps to undermine this sort of big bang approach to assessment, at least. And if you were a consumer, like an employer, for example, you could look at the range of tasks and assessment outcomes that somebody'd got in a much more granular way. And it might help to get away from the sort of very crude summative assessments like FIRST 2-1, 2-2, which cover so much detail, they're almost meaningless. But they are useful and usable.
They are, and we all understand them. I think looking at this idea of micro-credentials, which, for example, the University of London are one of the most recent to offer to a very wide market amongst a number of others. One can see how where the micro-credential or the learning relates directly to something in the job sphere, that credentialing it, for want of a better term, of you are competent at this bit of data science, is entirely possible. My comparison point is that my eldest child is reading history and politics, and I wonder how one compartmentalizes that to then say that there is something I can credential at the end in a small space, and it be anything other than a traditional three-year degree. Or are we just going to see a divide where there are traditional three-year degrees in more, and the word traditional just springs to mind, it's probably not the right one, in more traditional subjects, or rather than ones that are more vocationally aligned?
Yes, I mean, you go back a few centuries to, say, Oxford University. They didn't have any graduation at the end. You just read for your degree and then you got it if you'd spent 3 years in the university. I can't see that coming back, to be honest, for history and politics, however nice it would be. But the reason being, as I said earlier, that your son will need that bit of paper to negotiate the system of somebody will want to give him a job one day, perhaps, we hope. What I would say, though, is that, and I don't know if you want to get into the territory of AI, but I think what your son is going to need to manifest in the future, having read for the degree in history and politics, is actually more than just a competence in understanding the causes of the First World War or whatever it is. He's going to be required, I think, and want to demonstrate more generic competences and work-related skills and so on. So I think the kind of assessment that he might do, even for a very academic subject as the one you picked, is potentially possible. And when you think about the huge increase, for example, in the use of portfolio assessment, mm-hmm. where people often are required to do a portfolio, but they can choose what goes into it. And some of this, I like your phrase micro-credentialism. I hadn't heard that before, but it is what
definitely
we're talking
not
about.
Mine. Other people are going to be listening and think, "Ish, you've stolen it." Yes, not mine. Just hastening to add.
It's funny because the very earliest research I did in my career, which I didn't have much say over, was on something called records of achievement, which I think is now quite widely known.
Yes.
But Britain pioneered, and I mean Britain, all in the various countries of Britain, we pioneered the idea of a credential at the end of your school life, which everybody would get. Not just the people who are good at exams or could be allowed to take them, and that people would put into this record of achievement whatever they felt was an achievement, whether it was in school or at home or somewhere else. Great idea, including things like Duke of Edinburgh Awards and social service and all sorts of things. But in the end, and it got a long way in Britain, I mean, it was introduced as policy in England at least, but then it failed in terms of the spirit behind it, because it became a kind of dead thing you had to do and children hated it. But the portfolio's development in higher education, I think, has been very much more successful and is one of the ways through this morass that we're talking about.
For sure. I still have my national record of achievement, the Burgundy folder.
Do you?
I do. And back on my LinkedIn, I think in August of last year, I took photos of some of the highlights of it. And if I think back to it, I think part of it was being 16 or 17 and being handed this folder that had clear plastic wallets in it. And it was the lack of scaffolding or structure that for me, well, I suppose I went to a school where they gave us an idea of what should be in there. But that was, it felt like that was a school doing it. But if we think wider at portfolio, it's always led me to the point where I would very much like us to get to a stage where at an appropriate level, we are inviting people to submit what they believe meets the learning outcomes. I think that as someone who believes that they would have done better at the assessments they did through the course of their schooling and university and beyond, if I'd had more choice, It leaves me with that sort of, well, that would have been good for me. But thinking on a wider basis, people could be given more choice if they're given the ability and the literacy around it to make those choices. But you mentioned AI, and I've got a question or two for you on it, which I think, given your current research, I'm fascinated to hear your answers on them. And I'm going to start with one that is quite wide, which is, do you believe that AI is going to transform assessment and education, undermine it? Probably a bit of both. I mean, where are we going to go with AI specifically in the sphere of assessment rather than the broader learning and teaching assessment realm?
There is no question in my mind that it will transform assessment. Whether it's good transformation or a bad one is not a simple answer at all. And I, along with everybody else, have no idea what's going to be the end of this journey. I mean, it's all guesswork at the moment. But it is interesting to link an answer to your last comment on the record of achievement, because had you had access to AI, or even basic forms of technology, which I imagine you didn't at the time, then you could have done a much better job on your record of achievement, I suggest, because you could have used all those lovely new tools to do all sorts of exciting demonstrations of achievement. But so to answer your question, I think Well, the jury's definitely out, and the potential is enormous because, as I've just intimated, I think it will allow a lot of the drudgery of assessment to be removed, which is pretty obvious. The machine is just as capable of marking your maths homework as anybody else. And we're talking generative AI, the large language models like ChatGPT and so on. We're not talking about the basic AI. And when you think what those models can do in terms of increasingly almost modelling what a human can do, then in a way, the sky's the limit. And I'm actually, I struggle to envisage not just what assessment would look like, but also how the education system as a whole will be changed, because AI, can I just call it AI, is coming. I mean, already here, but it's coming much more. And we talk about people, jobs disappearing and all sorts of changes in society that will come as a result of this revolution. And it's a revolution as powerful as the advent of motor cars or anything like that. And so, you know, I'm not clever enough to work out what will happen. But I think if we start where we are, there is a fear, or there is a concern, shall we say, especially in higher education, that there's a lot of cheating going to happen as a result of AI, because, you know, I can get AI to write my history essay. I think there are going to be ways around that. But one of the things that the assessment community are going to have to figure out is how do we get an element of, how do we ensure that there is credibility in what we're assessing, i.e. that the person I'm looking at actually did this work in one way or another, and how can we ensure that it's not not a bot doing it of some kind? And there's a lot of concern about that at the moment. I think that problem will be solved one way or another by some kind of algorithm. Much more interesting, actually, is how AI will change the curriculum and what people need to be able to do to use AI effectively. And when you think how education's changed over the centuries, there's always been, you know, we don't do the trivium and the quadrivium anymore. We do other subjects. We didn't used to do science. It didn't exist, you know. So there has been massive change in the past and there can be in the future. So the question really is, what will society want its young people to be competent in doing in the future, and how will that be translated into the curriculum, whether that's in school or in higher education? And so how will history and politics be taught and assessed in the future when your son has access to limitless knowledge on his computer? And that worries me a bit, because whilst I'm not particularly enthusiastic about examinations which test memory and reasoning and the basic elements of Bloom's taxonomy, which is pretty much all they do, if we stop learning how to remember things because everything's available on our computer, that really is going to be quite bad for our brains and I think for our future operations in society. So I think at the moment we've got what I would call a Pandora's box, in the sense that we've taken the lid off the AI box and we don't know what's going to come out of it. And even the most global experts on AI don't know what the end of the road looks like. So we can't definitely get there this afternoon. But I think on the plus side, as I've intimated already, there is enormous potential to personalise the education that somebody receives and with that, the assessment that somebody undergoes. However, I think there are huge dangers in terms of not only credibility, but also the forces at work in our society, particularly, for example, that certainly inequality and students' access to both teaching and machinery, if you can call it that, but also more sinister things like surveillance. And we know already that there's huge amount of our data owned by companies like Google, and what are they going to do with it? But you can take that argument one stage further and say, well, Mr. Google and his ilk, these large language models, they're going to be inventing their own assessments that institutions can buy or individuals can buy, and then they're going to control through that what those individuals not only learn, but how they are assessed. So one of the worries I have, I hope I'm wrong, is that governments who currently control education systems in countries around the world will lose control of education systems, and it will become a free-for-all driven by consumerism, by the desire to make money by commercial outfits. And what that might result in, not only in terms of these organizations holding our data and using it, but also some degree of chaos in terms of how we use assessment in society, which is where I came in. That's really quite something. I don't know if that makes any sense to you.
It does. I was going to link the last thing you said back to something you said earlier, which is perhaps what we'll end up with is the familiarity of that government letter grade that they hand out being the piece of gold that makes the government-run assessment of value to people. What they will hang on to is the A grade or the 2-1 or whatever it might be as the thing that they know, and the shift in who's providing the assessments may still happen, but we hang on to government recognized letter grades as the thing that we know, love, and are comforted by, and so it prevents that from going away because we need that as the bit of comfort to the world that came before. But again, I hope I'm wrong about that too, because I would happily get rid of all of those letters and live in a world where people had a useful portfolio. Again, to use that example of people taking more traditional academic subjects, I'd be delighted if they left university with a portfolio of skills. The context might have been learning about the First World War, but they leave with that portfolio of skills that they can say, this is what I have, which is what's implied by the degree certificate you get, but we could be more overt about it to whether it's employer or just one another as the skills that one has acquired. But we have this assumption that someone who has been to university and got a good grade can write well, can speak well, can construct an argument, which is almost certainly right, but why have it as implication? Why not make it overt? I think is my pitch if I was going to change things. But then I forget I'm here to ask the questions, so I should probably stop. Patricia, this has been a really interesting discussion, and I know that the listeners of the podcast really do appreciate the insights and thoughts that they get, and you've really given us so much to think about on this episode. So I'm really grateful for you being on. I'm going to make sure that your latest paper is referenced in the notes to this podcast. So if you're listening or watching, whichever way you are and whichever medium you're on, you'll find a link to it. So Patricia, I want to thank you for being on the podcast on this episode. I want to thank our listeners and remind you, if you found this useful, please like, subscribe and share on whichever podcast platform you're on. If you have a moment to leave a review, that's always welcome. But for this episode, Patricia, thank you again. I've been Ishan Kolhatkar, and it's been a pleasure for you to join us. Thank you very much, and goodbye.